It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our exports, but it's not good if those weapons are then actually used in a war.
I know that area has had a lot of conflict and war, so I think selling weapons there will just make the situation worse.
South Korea is now the world's seventh largest arms dealer with prominent exports to Southeast Asia, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. Frank Smith, Seoul.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the Euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organized 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's a bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The largest biogas plant in Iran is under construction in the city of Mashhad. Biogas is a type of renewable fuel produced after organic waste, such as food scraps and agricultural waste, is decomposed in an oxygen-free environment, producing gases such as methane, which can be converted into electricity. Mashhad Biogas Plant will generate more than 22,000 megawatts of electricity per year.
At first glance, garbage is all about the expenses associated with its collection, dumping and burying. By using cutting-edge technologies in biogas system, we can generate energy from waste. We will transfer the gases produced in our landfills to the biogas plant and burn them to generate electricity.
Biogas is a mixture of gases produced in landfills, primarily consisting of methane, carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide. Since biogas technology will consume all these gases to produce energy, it will prevent the emission of large quantities of toxic gases like methane and CO2.
Methane is highly detrimental to the environment. Some experts say it is 200 times more contaminating than carbon dioxide, but the good news is it can be turned into electricity. So when we launch this plan next year, we'll breathe cleaner air with less methane emissions.
Every year, some 30 million visitors arrive in Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. This has made the bustling megacity the second in Iran after the capital Tehran to produce the most waste, with 2,000 tons of garbage generated every day. With biogas technology now available, more trash means more energy.
Each cubic meter of biogas with 60% methane content converts to 6.7 kilowatt hours energy. So the large amount of waste produced daily in Mashhad can be utilized efficiently to generate clean energy.
Mashhad already has a smaller biogas plant built on a landfill at the edge of the city. For now, authorities say biogas systems account for a small portion of electricity generated in the city. They're planning to turn biogas into one of the main energy sources with the aim of promoting the use of green fuels. Now that biogas is seen as a viable source of energy that's both renewable and eco-friendly, Mashhad Municipality says the emerging technology needs to dominate conventional methods of energy production. The city is now planning to build more biogas plants, which can both optimize waste management and produce clean energy. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said Syria is keen on maintaining continuous coordination with Iran, especially now amid rapid regional and international developments. He reiterated that Syria will not press ahead with talks with Turkey unless the goal was to end Turkish occupation in Syria and the support of terrorist organizations. Abdullahian said any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and the region, expressing Iran's trust in Syria's stances and decisions. The top Iranian diplomat held separate talks with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Maqdad, focusing on expanding economic and trade relations between both countries. In a joint press conference, Abdullahian touched upon Syrian-Iranian economic ties.
Our relations with Syria are at their best condition. We must exert our utmost efforts to boost economic ties to the level of our political ones. We agreed to prepare a long-term strategic cooperation document to be signed in the near future.
He indicated to Iran's role in preventing a planned Turkish military operation in northern Syria, welcoming diplomatic efforts for ending disputes between the two neighbors. Miqdad said the visit comes at a critical time amid challenges facing Syria.
The visit comes as we face challenges set by the U.S., the West, Israel, and their proxies. They don't want the Syrian people to heal. Our relations with Iran are strategic, and soon there will be steps taken that prove the depth of relations and both countries' belief in the necessity of enhancing them.
Miqdad said Syria will not forget the repeated Israeli aggressions, promising at the right time Syria will respond and inflict heavy losses on Israel in a way it will regret all its attacks. Amir Abdullahian's visit is part of a regional tour aimed at evaluating developments with Iran's allies. It's a reminder of the strong ties among member states of the Resistance Alliance, despite decades-long attempts to break them by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Flowers, gifts, and poems. In Iran, it is once again the time of the year to celebrate women, their progress, and their victories. Traditionally, 1 week is designated as Women's Week in Iran, which includes the birthday of Hazrat Fatimah, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, celebrated as Mother's Day.
The days of Women's Week have been named as follows. After Friday, which is of course Mother's Day, the day of women and their role in the family, Saturday is named Women and Virtue, Resisting Western Patriarchy, Sunday, Women and Self-Esteem, Leaders in Scientific Fields, Monday, Women, Creators of the Next Generation, Tuesday, Women, Buoyant, Resourceful and Wise, Wednesday, Women, Security and Social Justice, and Thursday, Women, Hopeful and Faithful.
But this year, Iranians are celebrating Women's Week, while under U.S. pressure, the Islamic Republic was removed from the United Nations Women's Commission, and as foreign-backed rioters have tried to exploit the concept of women and their freedom for their own political gains. So I asked the Vice President how women's status has changed over the past four decades.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women were given more opportunities to take on social roles. Women literacy has increased from 35% four decades ago to 95% today. More than 60% of university students and 30% of faculty members and professors are women. We have over 2,700 NGOs, mostly run by women.
An issue that was also raised by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a special meeting arranged to honor Women's Week. But most importantly, the leader pointed to the fact that solidarity is key, and the issue of hijab should not be exploited to divide women. Women who were present chanted slogans to show that they agree with the leader, and this is what's highlighted Women's Week this year.
The occasion this year is of more significance than ever before. It has become an opportunity to shed light on the fact that the recent foreign-backed riots and the exploitation of women to divide the country was a failed attempt by Iran's enemies. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UK's rogue royal, Prince Harry, has come under fire both at home and abroad, after admitting he killed 25 Afghans during his military service. In his highly controversial memoir, Spare, Harry claims he killed 25 people during his two tours of occupied Afghanistan, adding he didn't think of them as people, but instead as chess pieces that had been taken off the board.
Harry served as an attack helicopter pilot between 2012 and 2013. The book alleges that all the targets were combatants. However, following furious protests from inside Afghanistan, many British establishment critics have condemned the revelation, believing that it creates a new and unnecessary security threat against his own family members.
Amid the condemnation, British Muslims feel particularly outraged.
I don't think Harry should be silenced for what he said. In fact, I think he should be encouraged to go into more detail about the ideology and the training that's being pumped into British soldiers. It's not even the first time that he's likened killing humans with playing games. In 2013, he said it was a joy to use his controller during airstrikes. He said it was like playing a PlayStation or an Xbox.
Afghans are also furious, with many, including Taliban officials, issuing demands for Harry to be put on trial for war crimes.
The consensus in Afghanistan, and amongst probably Muslim opinion all around the world, is that he was involved in a war where hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghans were killed, a nation was destroyed, millions were displaced, and therefore he is a war criminal who should be accounted for his crimes. I run a British Muslim website, and we did an online poll the other day, and it had about 5,000 votes. It was a one-day poll, and 85% of our readers and viewers said that Prince Harry was a war criminal. And that's because Muslims, you know, we consider ourselves one body. And if one part of the body hurts, the whole of the body hurts.
Many British Muslims are left questioning how they now view a royal family with Muslim blood on its hands. Robert Carter, London.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest, and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil on Wednesday. 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters, as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime, led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. recent years, global warming has become a major environmental problem. Many of us are always faced with news relating to the global warming, and we hear warnings about the worsening situation. As time passes, we will experience the effects of global warming on our lives. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Britain's Met Office predicts next year is forecast to be one of the hottest on record, with global average temperatures forecast to be above 1.2 degrees Celsius, above what they were before humans started to drive climate change. If correct, it will be the 10th year in a row to see global average temperatures reach at least 1 degree Celsius above what they were used to be in pre-industrial times, measured as the period 1850 to 1900. The current hottest year on record, dating back to 1850, is 2016, a year that saw an El Niño climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which pushes up global temperatures on top of global warming trends. Professor Adam Scaife, head of long-range predictions at the Met Office, said, "Without a preceding El Niño to boost global temperatures, 2023 may not be a record-breaking year, but with the background increase in global greenhouse gas emissions continuing apace, it is likely that next year will be another notable year in the series." The Met Office's Dr. Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific." Dr. Nick Dunstan added, "La Niña has a temporary cooling effect on global average temperature. For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the 3 consecutive years with La Niña state, with a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific." Dr. Dunstan said, "This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Dr. Douglas Smith, a leading Met Office expert in climate prediction, added, "The fact that global average temperatures are at or above 1 degree Celsius for a decade masks the considerable temperature variation across the world." Dr. Douglas Smith said, "Some locations, such as the Arctic, have warmed by several degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times." The Met Office is forecasting a global average temperature of between 1.08 degrees Celsius and 1.32 degrees Celsius above what it was in the second half of the 19th century. Last year, the Met Office predicted 2022's global temperature will be between 0.97 degrees Celsius and 1.21 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, with a central estimate of 1.09 degrees Celsius. Data for the year to October suggests the temperature is about 1.16 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial era. Meanwhile, the Hindustan Times has also reported on the same story. The team, coordinated by the United Kingdom's Meteorological Office, in their first 5-year general outlook, said there is a 93% chance that the world will set in a record for hottest year by the end of 2026. Teams of meteorologists across the globe predicted the world is creeping closer to the warming threshold international agreements are trying to prevent, with nearly a 50-50 chance that Earth will temporarily hit that temperature mark within the next 5 years. A team of 11 different forecast centres predicted for the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, Recently, with human-made climate change continuing, there's a 48% chance that the globe will reach a yearly average temperature of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels of the late 1800s at least once between now and 2026, a bright red signal in climate change negotiations and climate science. Britain's Met Office senior scientist Leon Hermanson, who coordinated the report, said, "We're going to see continued warming in line with what is expected with climate change. Those forecasts are big picture global and regional climate predictions on a yearly and seasonal timescale based on long-term averages and state-of-the-art computer simulations. They're different and increasingly accurate weather forecasts that predict how hot or how wet a certain day will be in specific places. But even if the world hits that mark of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, the globe has already warmed about 1.1 degrees Celsius, or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since the late 1800s. That's not quite the same as the global threshold first set by international negotiators in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In 2018, a major United Nations science report predicted dramatic and dangerous effects on people and the world if warming exceeds 1.5 degrees Celsius. Several scientists said the global 1.5 degree threshold is about the world being that warm, not for 1 year, but over a 20 or 30 year time period. This is not what the report predicts. Hermanson said meteorologists can only tell if Earth hits that average mark year, maybe a decade or two, after it is actually reached there, because it is a long-term average. Climate scientist Zeke Hofstra of the tech company Stripper and Berkeley Earth, who wasn't part of the forecast team, said the prediction makes sense given how warm the world already is, and an additional tenth of a degree Celsius, nearly 2/10 of a degree Fahrenheit, is expected because human-caused climate change in the next 5 years. And to add, the likelihood of a strong El Niño, the natural period warming of parts of the Pacific Ocean that alter world weather, which could toss another couple of tenths of a degree on top of that temporarily, and the world gets very close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The English website of Al Jazeera Network has also reported on the same story. A new United Nations report has found that the past 8 years were the 8 hottest ever recorded, indicating the world is now deep into the climate crisis. It said the internationally agreed 1.5 degrees Celsius limit for global heating is now barely within reach. The report by the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, WMO, set out how record high greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are driving sea level and ice melting to new highs and supercharging extreme weather from Pakistan to Puerto Rico. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that the global average temperature in 2022 will be about 1.15 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial average, meaning every year since 2016 has been one of the warmest years on record. For the past 2 years, the natural La Niña climate phenomena has actually kept global temperatures lower than they would otherwise have been. The inevitable switch back to El Niño conditions will see temperatures surge even higher in the future, on top of global heating.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In the UK, while union leaders hold a protest outside of Downing Street, MPs are debating legislation which would see striking workers in key sectors be legally required to provide a minimum service, which draws the question, is the UK trying to take away a freedom granted under Western democracy called the right to strike and the freedom of assembly? Well, strikers have said they will fight tooth and nail to protect the right to strike. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at why the UK believes that it can prevent the right to strike in its country, yet encourage people in other countries not to go out to strike, like in the Islamic Republic, not to mention commit acts of violence. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Chris Williamson joins us. He's a former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified from Derby, UK. Also from the UK, London, John Ross, senior fellow at Chung-Yung Institute for Financial Studies, and a former advisor to London Mayor Ken Livingstone.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Let me first start with you, Chris Williamson. So what are we looking at when it comes to this bill? Because it's, ultimately it says that it's going to take away the right to strike for the people in the UK. But in what way is it going to do that once it's official and once it's passed? Because there seems to be a certain sneaky way, for lack of a better word, that the UK government is approaching this issue.
Well, I think the government, the British government, is guilty of breathtaking double standards. There's two pieces of legislation they're seeking to push through at the moment. One relates to the Freedom of Assembly, the Public Order Bill, but they're also pushing through a bill, as you mentioned in your introduction there, which will limit the right to strike for trade unions. It's the so-called strike minimum service level bill, which will limit the right to strike in various sectors like the health sector, fire and rescue service, education, transport, and border security, etc. And, you know, whilst we've got politicians kind of lecturing other countries around the world and standing up in support of protests in different parts of the globe, here in Britain, they're seeking to clamp down on the very rights which they claim to advocate. So, as I say, it is a real grotesque case of breathtaking double standards. And, you know, I don't think the trade union movement or indeed civil society is in any mood actually to accept this. And regrettably, both sides of the chamber in the House of Commons, well, you've got the government, which are obviously pushing this legislation through, but, you know, the opposition's position is fairly lukewarm. And so I think, you know,
why is that? I read about that. Why is the opposition lukewarm on this?
Well, I mean, we've seen a very different direction that's been taken by the Labour Party since the demise of Jeremy Corbyn after he was stepped down as leader of the Labour Party and was then suspended from the party. And the new leader, Sir Keir Starmer, and his cohorts are very much in the model, I suppose, of Tony Blair. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people see them as a pale version of the Conservative Party. So I think the way in which we'll defeat this legislation is through action on the street, through a mass movement. I don't think we can rely on the political class in the Houses of Parliament to actually do the job for us.
Sure. Let's break this down, however, a little bit here, John Ross, because we need to understand what is being passed. And one of the bills is looking at the fact that lives are at risk, if I'm correct to understand that. And it says that it was needed based on the way that it was presented by the government because we have seen in recent months a flare-up of strikes that is, in essence, putting people's lives at risk. But then you have people like the firefighters who have said, you got rid of 12,000 firefighter jobs, never mind the safety on the days that we're on strike. What about safety on every other day of the year? So you can see that there is this schism there based on this particular statement coming from the firefighters. Do you buy this legislation that's being passed?
No, this is like a schism describing the difference between a molehill and Mount Everest and saying, look, they're both got humps on them. The government has literally killed, or allowed to be killed, to be precise, and much of that, thousands, tens of thousands of people through the neglect of the NHS, through its policies on COVID alone, which is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths. And they have produced no evidence that anybody has died on any strike day, because the fact is that the strikers make sure that for the most life-threatening situations, there is cover. This talk about minimum cover is a complete fake, because the unions have never put themselves in a situation in which they're withdrawing cover in which there is life-threatening situations. And so what the unions say there is absolutely correct on this. It's not a schism at all. I mean, what it really shows is the problem the government has got. I mean, Britain's survived for, you know, hundreds of years without this legislation, this type of legislation. The reason that they're going to act now is because so many people are opposed to what they're doing. So because they're no longer facing a situation in which you've got some thousands or tens of thousands of people, they're confronting now strikes which regularly, you know, have 100,000 people involved. If you take the strike wave altogether, it involves millions of people. They're facing such big opposition, they're forced to take authoritarian measures, and they're the people who have created the responsibilities for these deaths.
All right, let me just cite a statistic. I think it's appropriate time to do that, because when we take a look at the strikes that happened last year, as an example, 417,000 working days were lost in October. Office of National Statistics said that 205,000 working days lost in September, the worst strike since 1990, and 1.1 million working days to industrial action since June. And, of course, 2023, we've seen what's happened. I figured I'd just plug that in there. So, Chris Williamson, trying to understand what the UK government is doing. Based on what I'm reading over here, is this proposed new legislation give the employers the option to fire workers and then sue trade unions? Is that one of the things that this will do in one form or another?
That's certainly the direction of travel that they're taking. And we're already seeing the fire and rehire of workers. And, you know, what the government, despite their sort of weasel words, when we saw some pretty, you know, gratuitous examples of that last year, yes, I mean, they're seeking to you know, make that even easier for employers to, I mean, literally exploit workers to an even greater extent than they already are. I mean, we've got 14.5 million people in the UK living in poverty already, and precarious employment is now endemic throughout the land. And the only way in which workers can protect themselves is by combining together and forming trade unions. And obviously what the government are seeking to do is to make it more difficult for people to, one, join a trade union, and then when, you know, unions are representing the workers, to make it difficult for the unions actually to effectively represent their members. I mean, you know, the archaic way in which, you know, unions are expected to undertake a postal ballot in order to secure support for a you know, piece of industrial action, I mean, it's absurd, particularly in the modern age when we have access to, you know, new technology, and this could be done, you know, in a much more swift and more democratic way, actually. So they're trying to put obstacles in the way, it seems to me, of organised labour, and they very clearly are working in the interests of corporate capitalism, let's be clear about it. You know, the global corporations, that's whose side they are on. And I regret to say that, you know, the opposition is pretty much in the same ballpark as the Conservative Party are. Yes, there'll be, you know, modifications at the edges, but ultimately that's where the political class's priorities actually lie. They lie in the support for corporate capitalism, not in standing up for the interests of the people who actually elect them, the vast majority, the 99%.
Sure. Well, let's look at the sectors here then, let me play the devil's advocate, if I may, John Ross. I mean, first of all, the sectors that we're looking at here are health service, rail, education, fire, and border security, from what I'm reading here. Now, to play the devil's advocate here, some are going to say, listen, what are these strikes going to really do, aside from the fact that they're going to hurt the economy, let the government do its job, and see if they can come up with a solution, and that these strikes are not going to get anywhere. I mean, some people may be thinking that. So what would you say to those people?
Well, on the several things. Firstly, the strikes themselves are greatly influencing public opinion. All the opinion polls show that the strikers in general have the support of the public, and in some group cases, nurses, they have absolutely overwhelming support of the public. But other groups have got support from the rail workers, etc., for example. Secondly, this is very, very necessary in order to defend people's lives. There was a very interesting article in one of the papers today noting the fact that the health situation in the country has got so bad that it's very seriously affecting the economy. Because you've now got a situation in which you've got a huge increase in sickness. We already know that the workforce has fallen by about 500,000 since before COVID. That's due to all the people suffering from long COVID and the effects of COVID. And you've now got a situation where people are taking more time off from sick, et cetera, because they're ill. So in other words, it's having a very negative effect from the point of the economy. So the point is, it's necessary to fight back against this. The thing which I'm afraid I agree with on Chris is what the government is so unpopular now that I'm pretty sure that it's going to lose the next election. And what it's relying upon is the fact that the Labour Party won't repeal this legislation. It's verbally said it will, but they believe they won't do it in practice. And it will continue with the same policies, because these and that will, of course, then make the next Labour government itself drastically unpopular. And so then we can have another Conservative government would do something worse. So on the contrary, these protests is the only way that people can fight back and defend the situation. And they're not acting merely in their own interests. They're acting in the interests of everybody. I mean, we've got massive shortages of workers in the health service, doctors, nurses, etc., because they've been paid too little.
Sure, indeed. Well, I'm looking at a campaign. I don't know if you've heard of it. You may have, Chris Williamson, called Enough is Enough. And
yes,
what it's saying, aside from the fact that the right to strike is under threat, it says that the new legislation will override a worker's right to withdraw their labor, forcing them to work against their will. And the important point here, one of them, is that it says it's no accident that this right is actually being under attack at the very moment that they're trying to fight back this cost of living crisis and the squeeze that they're feeling. Do you agree with that?
I very much do agree with that. And the Enough is Enough campaign has really captured the imagination of the public. I think the last time I looked, they've got nearly 1 million supporters. So, you know, clearly they've tapped into a nerve amongst the British public. People are sick and tired, frankly, of the poor conditions, the high rents that people are expected to pay, the precarious employment, the lack of opportunity, the deterioration in our public services, the fact that young people are saddled with massive debts if they have the temerity to get a higher education at university, come out with, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 pounds in debt, then it's difficult for them to find accommodation in which to live. Rents are very expensive, almost impossible in most parts of the country for young people to get a foot on the housing ladder to buy their own home, and public housing is, virtually non-existent as a result of policies that have been pursued over the last sort of four decades. But as far as the legislation is concerned in relation to trade unions, let's remember when New Labour came into power in 1997, they did make some modification to the anti-trade union legislation that had been pushed through by Margaret Thatcher and John Major's governments. But what Tony Blair was crowing about was the fact that even after the changes, modifications that they were going to make to the anti-trade union legislation, what Tony Blair said is that Britain would still have the most restrictive trade union laws in the Western world, as if that somehow was a good thing. So I think John's absolutely right that it's very unlikely that if indeed the Labour Party do win the next election, that they will do very much to actually repeal the legislation, which, if indeed it does get onto the statute book, which is being pushed through right now. Look, talk is cheap. Actions speak louder than words. And the fact is that the front bench, the Labour front bench, have been banned by Sir Keir Starmer to show their solidarity, to show their support for the striking workers, the nurses, the transport workers, the postal workers. They've been banned on the,
yeah,
on the ascendancy.
We're, unfortunately, there's a technical problem here, Chris Williamson. I'm sorry, we're getting cut off intermittently here. Let's see here. So what has the government done so far, as you see it, John Ross? I mean, they're not reaching an agreement with the striking different sectors that are striking that have government pay. They have proposed some increases, but it's not enough. And I'm going to tie that in with what this Enough is Enough campaign has said, where the government, their statement, the government is determined to force workers to pay the price for a crisis caused by the greed of the elite. Yet again, do you think that accusation is justified?
Well, certainly. I mean, all the evidence. I mean, Enough is Enough is a good campaign. There are other campaigns, well, the People's Assembly and others who are campaigning against austerity. The whole series of campaigns and trade unions on this, of which Enough is Enough is one. Yeah, but they're all, yes, they are. Because all the statistics show that at the present time, the rich are getting richer. This is not just a slogan. Wealth has been greatly increased for the billionaires and millionaires. The income differentials has increased. At the same time as literally millions of people are suffering cuts in, well, millions of people are being forced into extreme poverty. Virtually everybody outside of the top sort of, you know, few percent of the population is suffering cuts in living standards. Nevertheless, the most wealthy in the country have got better off. And the government is doing not merely precisely nothing about it. It's genuinely attempting to create such conditions. And therefore, that's why it's in a big mess. So people are striking back against this. Because it's not a case that everybody's in the same boat. We're not all in the same boat. And what the new thing, which is getting the government, is that they're hitting people who've never got any history of militancy at all. And the Royal College of Nursing hasn't had a strike for 100 years. In fact, this is the first strike in its 100-year existence. Criminal barristers have been on strike, in addition to, you know, what you might call the usual people on strike. Such as rail workers. This is touching extremely wide layers of the population, and that's why the government is so worried about it and why it's taking such authoritarian measures in the situation. It's not, they're attempting to claim this is due to some small group of extremists, but all this data that is involved and the groups of people involved show it's absolutely not. This is very wide sections of the population are completely fed up with the situation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And there are also different aspects of this bill that do target different movements, which is something I think we need to talk about here. Because based on, again, what I'm reading here, Chris Williamson, groups like Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, just to name a few, they've all, based on how they see it, have used, they call it disruptive tactics in order to bring to attention their motto or their theme, which are basically protests against the government. So what's your reaction to that? I mean, are they trying to just sweep their problems under the rug for it not to be highlighted? Because after all, protests do highlight things that are worthy for the government to actually address once they see the importance of it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, rather than actually addressing the concerns which are being articulated by the groups that you've mentioned, what the government is trying to do is to shut down those protests, to, as it were, sweep away the, you know, the potential embarrassment that they cause the government by drawing attention to their failings. And certainly there is very real concern because, you know, these powers are quite draconian, you know. I mean, the right to give them to the police to stop protests in their tracks, to increase the powers of stop and search, to criminalise what they refer to as locking on, the sort of tactic that was used by the suffragettes, you know, well over 100 years ago to secure votes for women. These sort of activities will be criminalised. And there is a real fear. I mean, already black people are targeted and are subject to sort of draconian powers that the police already have at their disposal in terms of stop and search. And this is going to increase. And I think black people, you know, an Asian community in Britain are likely to be targeted to an even greater extent. So it's really crucial, you know, that we do build this mass protest, this mass opposition to what the government is doing, and really force political change, force the Labour Party, frankly, you know, to speak up and actually do what they are supposed to do. And that is, you know, to kind of, you know, as it were, represent the sort of progressive interest in this country. It's a tragedy, frankly, that, you know, the direction the Labour Party has taken of late. And that's why it's encouraging to see movements like Enough is Enough and other protest movements really, you know, stepping up and taking to the streets in the numbers that we've not seen in this country for decades.
Yes, and that's going to continue from the looks of it, at least until now, unless a solution comes up. But that remains to be seen. Since we've almost ran out of time, my final question goes to you, John Ross. It's very hard to take a look at the UK government passing legislation to the degree that we just spoke about, and yet at the same time encourage protests in other countries, and in particular, obviously I'm referring to, in this case, in point of the Islamic Republic. I mean, you can't have a TV station that you're funding and ask them to encourage protesters to come out not only incite violence, but also host other TV stations like a Saudi-funded one, of which they're more extreme, of which we call it a terrorist media station, to do the same, if not to some degrees even harsher. Is that a valid assessment to make on this?
Well, yeah. To understand the so-called free speech in the West, you have to understand what is the situation. If you're discussing something which really doesn't matter very much, or you're tiny, that is, you don't influence the situation, or you're discussing something which is not very important, then you can have free speech. If you're either, you have very powerful positions, or you're discussing something which is extremely important, then you get the clamp down on free speech. That's always been the rule. If you want to have a big discussion in Britain, should we drive on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the road? I'm sure it won't be interfered with by the state, because it won't affect anything very much, except in practical terms. If